How often do you think about what your life will look like in 5 years or 10 or 20 or even 30 years? In other words, how often do you think about your future self? Today on 50 Fires, my guest is UCLA Professor Hal Hirschfield. Hal is an expert on decision-making, and particularly on the impact our decisions today will have on our future self, which is actually really helpful when you're talking about money.
If we do this, there's other things we can't do, or we're going to have to wait longer on.
That's coming up today on 50 Fires.
Blind Nil Audio.
Greetings, Carl here. As a professor of marketing, behavioral decision-making, and psychology at UCLA's business school, Hal Hirschfield is one of my favorite people to have a conversation about money. Hal literally wrote the book about the future self, this concept that concerns both the process and the consequences associated with thinking about ourselves in the future. And when you think about that in the context of money, when we feel connected to who we want to be in the future, we are much more likely to make good decisions now. I've known Hal for a while, and the last time we spoke, it was around the release of the book I just mentioned, simply titled Your Future Self, How to Make Tomorrow Better Today, which I highly recommend. So let's get into it. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and certified financial planner, and today I'm talking about money with Hal Hirschfield. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning.
I'm in the right headspace. I'm fully here and I'm ready to like have my therapy session.
Yeah, amazing. I'm actually kind of curious why you said yes to this conversation.
I love talking to you.
Oh, that's nice.
I don't know my like relationship with money. It's like I was reflecting on this. It's like I feel like everyone's relationships with money are, you know, complicated in their own ways. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe mine's less so, maybe it's more. I don't know. We'll talk. We'll see.
Well, tell me, what were you thinking about? When you're thinking about, like, when you use the words, my relationship with money is less or more, like, what came to mind?
So, I mean, I'm fortunate that I didn't grow up in a household that was like paycheck to paycheck. You know, I hear people tell the story of like, oh, I got into this field. I started to try to understand money because my parents didn't. That wasn't the case for me. I grew up in a, you know, rural area that was like quite blue collar. Though my parents were professionals. So I was like, we weren't going on crazy vacations and we weren't spending a lot of money on anything. And like, I know what properties cost where they grew up, where I grew up. And it's like way, way less than anything I see in LA. Yeah. But I was like comfortable. And I never got the sense that my parents were stressed by money. So that never diffused to me, but they also never talked about it. And I, you know, and that's a funny thing because I'm now at the stage of parenting my own kids and I'm like, you know, we went skiing this weekend and I felt the need to tell them that, you know, your mom and I have made a very intentional decision that this is something we want you to learn to do and that we know we'll have fun doing it together, but like, it's not without a cost. And like, you should know that. but I don't know, you know, I constantly question like, is that what's the right amount of intergenerational conversations around money.
Yeah. I really don't want to forget to talk about that exact conversation about the skiing with the kids because I'm super curious how you handled it. I think it might be helpful because I'm really curious. Like, what was your earliest memory of money?
I have a very specific one. I mean, it's kind of funny and I don't know if it's money per se, but we had the World Book Encyclopedia. Like the whole thing.
So did we. Yeah. So funny for people to like, you can imagine like how many was that? How
it was like two bookshelves. I mean, it was like, you know, not a giant, like, but like,
isn't like 30 or like, yeah. 30, like it's A, B, C, but there were some letters that had more. So it was, yeah.
And the article about money in the M book.
In the M book.
Like if you open the M book, it just opened to money because I was fascinated by it. Like looking at the different types. This sounds made up. It's not made up. I mean, I'm an only child. I didn't have siblings. So I was like, I thought like there's all these different types of money. And like, I was obsessed with the idea that there used to be a $10,000 bill, I think, you know, and like, I would constantly look at it. And then I had an uncle, like a great uncle, who is a coin collector. And I thought the idea that I could be holding a coin that someone touched decades earlier was fascinating. But what I didn't think about then and what I think about now is like the idea of like how much more that coin could have gotten them, like someone 70 years before me. And that's the type of thing that, you know, now is, I think about, but that's my, you know, if you wanted my earliest memory of money, it's probably that coupled with like, you know, making my first decision about like how to spend. Like, I think maybe one of the first things I bought was like a, this is going to date me again, but like a double CD. And I'll tell you what it was. It was, I'm pretty sure it was Queen's Greatest Hits, 'cause it had just come out after Wayne's World, right?
So good.
Or it had been re-released, you know, and so it was like...
Yeah, those double CDs were... So first of all, how old were you when you discovered the M section of the encyclopedia that had money in it?
I should ask my folks. I mean, probably 7, 8, maybe.
Well,
you know?
And I'm really curious about, because I one of my favorite questions has been, can you remember the first time you held a large sum of money in your hands? But you've already pointed to like, what was it about the fascination that you held a coin that like, what was that?
You know, I think like for one, I mean, there's probably a couple things. One is like, I have a little bit of like an obsessive personality. And so it was like, I was also like really into collecting baseball cards and trying to get the full team, you know, and there was something about the idea of like trying to get like different versions of the same coin, but also it was like, I don't know. For me, I really think it was this idea that this thing like traveled through time and like somehow landed in my hands and like, you know, that it meant something. And like, I don't know, I'm sure I shared this fascination that a lot of kids, well, I don't know if this is true anymore, but I feel like I had this fascination of like gold, you know, and gold bars and like
yeah.
What that meant, you know, but like, if I'm being honest and I'm trying to be like as like introspective as I can with this conversation, I'm lucky that I didn't think a lot about like what did the money get me or didn't get me. Like, I grew up in a very, for better or for worse, and often for worse, like a pretty homogenous like town where there wasn't like, it wasn't like I looked at some kids who had like massive amounts of wealth and other ones who didn't. It was like, you know, the variance around the mean was pretty, pretty narrow. You know, and there's something that there's downsides that, you know, to that type of town as well. But, you know, where I live now, I look and it's like, I've already heard my 8-year-old ask me why we don't have a house that's as big as so-and-so's house. And I feel like, my gosh, we, we're lucky to have this house that we do.
Yeah.
You know,
that keeps coming up. And I think it must be the age cohort of guests, but it keeps coming up that like your comparison set was so homogenous.
I try to think about the things I wanted. It's like, I remember wanting to, you know, I'd have a friend sleep over and like, there was like back, I remember there was a number you could call to get tips for like some of the Nintendo games. And it wasn't cheap, you know, it was like $1 a minute or something like that. And it was like, I remember begging my mom, like, can we just call like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, blah, blah. And like, she would normally say yes, but that was like what I wanted, you know?
Right, right. That's so interesting because there's so much in this, you know, especially in your work professionally, like there's so much around mimetic desire and all the, you know, comparative sets and who you compare yourself to and the variance around a mean, yeah, as you referred to earlier, that I just think causes so many problems for our kids, you know?
Absolutely.
And us.
I find myself saying, on the one hand, you don't need that. Like, don't make that comparison. Like, let's be happy with what we have. And on the other hand, it's like, you know, I don't want my kid to be dissatisfied or unhappy with something. And, you know, so it's easy to like say, well, okay, well, we're not going to get a bigger house, but like, can I get you a nicer vacation? You know, there's like all those other little things.
Right.
and right. who are we getting influenced by, you know?
Isn't that interesting how, and what do you make of this? Like, I think it's always like cute of adults to be like, oh, peer pressure. Oh, look at the kids dealing. But it's interesting how insidiously it slips into our lives, you know? And especially when it comes, I'm curious about like when you mix in a very, it's not genetic, but just a traditional historical role of providing, no matter which spouse it is, but like, and a spouse couple, you know, parents want to provide, but what it means to provide these days.
No, I think it's very different.
And how do you think about that? And how have you handled it with your kids even?
Yeah. When you, it's fine. What you're asking me, it just reminds me of something slightly different, and then I'll get back to that. But
yeah, please.
I have this memory when I was finishing like my, I won't get too academic, but when I was finishing my postdoc and moving my first faculty job, I remember turning to one of my friends who was a professor. He was already a professor. And I was like, ah, I can't wait to finally have like a real paycheck. Cause you know, I was a grad student and then I was a postdoc. And I said, I'm going to save so much money. And he looked at me and he said, for a couple months. And then he said, and you'll just find that like the jacket you bought before, like now you want this one. And like the, you know, the vacation you want before, now you want that one. And he was like, everything's going to be just a little step up until before you know it, you're now at your, like the same capacity you were at before.
New baseline.
And even though he said that, he was, and I was aware of this process happening, like he couldn't have been more right. And it's something I think about all the time now, especially with the kids, where I think, you know, I think about the idea that I want to be aware of when that sort of, what do you want to call it, desire creep or whatever it is, starts entering into the picture, because then it takes over all other little, you know, it's like got tentacles, right? It hits all the other sort of areas of our life. And it's very easy to have it happen when you say, well, I want my kid to have more of this opportunity, you know, or that thing. And like, I can tell myself, we're not spending on material stuff. And I really don't think we are, but I'm sure everything is relative. I'm sure compared to somebody else I am. And then I say, well, experientially, like it's really important that they, that we have this vacation or that we go skiing or whatever it is. And, you know, when I interviewed you for my book, the reason I reached out to you originally is because you had said this bit about, you know, we say save for the future, but there's always the other side of that coin, spend for the future. And that has changed a lot of my relationship with money, you know, and coupled with some of Brian Portney's stuff on funded contentment, I've spent a lot of time thinking about like, how do I use money to create experiences that will one day become memories? But it's very easy to get sucked into that and do too much of it, right? Where then you're like, oh shoot, why was the credit card bill so much this month?
Yeah. What have you found in terms of like mental models or just thinking tools? Like what questions do you ask to help yourself sort through that? Because I think it's like, this is really important to me. You know, and Brian's concept of funded contentment is fantastic. But how do you approach that?
You know, it's funny because I'd be lying if I said that I always approached it intentionally. I've always had a very sort of like rough mental budget. You know, I sort of know what like we should spend on different categories. And the problem with that is that then other things crop up and then I'm, you know, doing some mental accounting gymnastics from taking from one account, moving to the other. And
those sneaky little one-time events that happen every month.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. The, you know, the exceptional expenses that are never an exception. Right.
Right.
And you know, this year is the first year I sort of said, let's look at this all in advance. Like what are the big things that we want to spend money on? I mean, I'll give you an example where like the same thing has happened the last couple of years, which is my sister-in-law calls sometime in the fall and says, we're going to go on spring break. Do you guys want to join us? Her husband, my brother-in-law, travels a lot for his job. He gets all these, you know, airline miles and hotel miles. Basically, their trip is more or less free. I mean, not free, you know, but, you know, it's like to them, it feels free. And so the same thing happens every year, which is my wife says, sister just called. They're booking already. Should we book? And I said, I don't know. It's a lot of money. Like, I'm not prepared to think about this. And she says, well, we should probably book it now and we can always cancel, because if we decide later that we want to do it, it's too late. Oh
So relatable, by the way. Yeah.
And yeah. And like we have the same conversation. And this past year, I was like, all right, fine, we'll book it, but I got to see. And, you know, doing this whole sort of overall big picture thing was important because, and by the way, last year when we went, it was an amazing experience. Like our kids and their kids, you know, their cousins, and they're getting all these, like, they're getting like real time together, and like we're getting time together. And it's like, it's really important. Now, could we do that same thing somewhere else? Like, sure. But, you know, it's like, this is what happened. So I think, you know.
Hey, it's Carl. I know I mentioned this in the introduction to this episode, but Hal is an expert on the concept of future self, how we think about ourselves in the future. And that has broad implications about the decisions we make today with our money, something as common as the phrase retirement planning. But it also has to do with, are we going to take that vacation next year when our sister-in-law calls? So I found it super interesting that Hal, who is really an expert, struggles with this too. In fact, I find that comforting. So if you struggle with ideas like mental accounting or this pesky little situation with one-time expenses that seem to come up every single month, or the idea that you spend a bunch of emotional or mental energy on thinking about whether you're going to take a trip next month or next year, just know that you're not alone.
I think, you know, one of the conversational points that's come up a lot this year is like, if we do this, there's other things we can't do, or we're going to have to wait longer on. And, you know, to be able to sort of say, like, have a little bit of the conversation of like, what's important and like, where will I put my money, has been that's not really a mental model per se, but it's just become so much more relevant to me to say, like, you know, there's certain things where like our car, we got very old, and, you know, every time we take it in, it was costing money. And I was like, this is really, you know, we're losing money on this. We need to buy a new car. But I was like kind of pushing it out because I like didn't want to spend the money upfront on it, you know? And so whether that makes sense or not, you know, I don't know, because I probably spent more money. Like
it's so fascinating that what you pointed to in terms of trade-offs.
Yeah.
And also like what you're pointing to on that vacation is, it's interesting to me to get underneath, like, it's not about the trip. I mean, it could be, but what's the value that we're investing in, right? So it gets shifted from an expense, which it is, mm-hmm. but what are we investing in there?
Yeah.
And you even mentioned, like, could we do that a different way? Well, sure. But the idea that, like, okay, I'm going to delay the car, you know?
Right.
And one of the choices we're making is we're going to invest more heavily in this. I don't think we take that step very often. We think just like, this is just a balance sheet and it's a set of calculators, and we don't, and I back to the coin in your hands. Like, right. I don't know if some of that, like, energy for me, that energy is like, for a very long time, people have been trading almost a little bit of themselves,
right?
Time and energy and skill to make a thing. I made it. You gave me a coin for it. Now my like life energy is like in this coin. I'm going to pass it around. And those trade-offs used to be very real. Like, I looked you in the eyes and you gave me a thing that you grew in your garden. And I traded for, you know, a piece of woodwork that I did. And there was this very like, the stuff was embedded. And we've become so disconnected from it that we're not even making the connection that the money we just spent was about friendship and family and memories.
That's such an interesting perspective, because you're right. It's so abstract now, you know, and it's really, speaking of kids, when I've tried to like explain money, like, you know, the second you scratch the surface beyond like, what does this $5 bill do? All of a sudden it's like, I feel like we're having a very late night conversation with some serious drugs to try to explain. Well, it's an imaginary system, and it goes from my bank account to this other one, and there's a central house that, you know, and you're like, wait, what is he talking about? You know?
Yeah. I've tried that a couple times with friends.
The late night conversation with serious drugs.
Yeah, no. I've tried that a couple times, the late night. I've tried with friends, like, pretend like I don't know and help me understand what is money. It's almost the only equivalent I've ever had was pretend like I've never tasted salt. Describe for me what salt is. You know, like you can describe what it's not, but it's really hard to be like what it is. And I think part of that is this abstraction, because it's zeros and ones largely.
Yeah, that's right.
And we've gotten so far, and I actually have a sense that that disconnect, that rift between embedding money with meaning, I think it's one of the crux problems we have in, this is a big claim, but society-wide. Like, I think it leads to power and war and, you know, like all of those things.
Yeah. Oh, I think you're absolutely right. Because my suspicion is that there's a lot of times where people are chasing the idea of having more money. And it's not totally disconnected, right? I think there is this, you know, this desire to make more money for the sake of making more money. And it's not like totally disconnected money from what it buys you, but I think it effectively is. I think people sort of assume if I have more money, I'll have more X, Y, and Z that will make life better for me, right? Like, I think that's the rough calculus there, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But I think that link between the more money and more things, experiences, et cetera, I think that's like frayed. And so people sort of just focus on the making more money and sort of forget how to spend it in ways that then increase the other things that like make the whole point of having money worthwhile. Yeah. That's my suspicion at least. You know?
No, totally. We just had Morgan Housel and Gretchen on, and they talked about how they literally run little experiments. And I love this idea of like, okay, to me, the solution is to engage in the never-ending process of aligning my use of capital, time, money, energy, and attention, my use of capital with what's actually important to me. And both sides of that equation are going to be a never-ending process. Like, I'm not exactly sure what's important to me, I think, but what if I run a little experiment? And so like Morgan's example was, he kind of feels like he should be a car guy. So he's like, every once in a while and he says, I have to do it every couple of years to remind myself, when I'm on a trip for like work and I go to the rental place, he's like, you know what? Just, you know, it's a couple $100 extra a day. Give me the Porsche. And he says he normally doesn't even get off the lot before he's like, oh my gosh, I admire this thing. It is so beautiful. It's amazing. And I'm not a car guy.
That's really funny.
And I love that experiment of testing the value.
Yeah.
And saying like, because I think what you're saying is we live pretty unexamined.
Yeah.
In terms of the assumptions we're making about the job we're giving money.
Yeah. No, it's so true. But, you know, that's really interesting because that's another level, right? Like, I mean, I think that I've made more of an effort and my wife and I have made more of an effort to go from like less examined to more examined, but we're not running experiments. And I mean, I'm a social scientist. You know, I should be running them, you know?
We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I'm having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back to 50 Fires. What else have you seen in the conversations you've had with kids and maybe even the work you've done around this idea of getting more examined, more clear? And why do we continually make that mistake?
Yeah, so I have a hypothesis here. I think money is a little bit like eating, right? Or, you know, or rather spending money is a little bit like eating, where I think we'd be a lot better at these sorts of things if we had a few decisions to make. You know, if it was like a high level decision of like, do I spend more or do I save more? all right, you know, that's a hard thing to decide, but maybe I'll decide. And it's like, okay, fine, I'm done. But I might have this desire to, you know, eat healthier. And I'll tell you that right now. And then, you know, I know that we have a box of Girl Scout cookies sitting over there. And, you know, after this call, who knows? Like, I tell you that I'm not going to eat, and there's a good chance I'll do it. I think, you know, money's a little bit the same way, where it's like each decision, and we touched upon it earlier, right? But I think each decision can be made an exception. I mean, actually, we talked about something a little bit different, right? Which is that, you know, we have this tendency to think about like one-off expenses as like, oh, those won't happen again. But we have those frequently, right? Mm. But this is a different thing, which is that like each time we have a decision point, it's really easy to not treat that decision point as part of like the overall fabric of all of our decisions, right? And so then, you know, before you know it, all these little things add up. You know, I've never done this, but I would love to say, like, I bet you that what accounts for the lion's share of overspending, maybe somebody's done this study and I don't know it, but I bet you that what accounts for the lion's share of overspending is not that I like find myself getting a new TV every month or like a new bike or whatever, but that like there's a bunch of little things that add up, you know, that like if I, you know, and I'm, let's not do the like, oh, well, if I stop getting lattes, not that, but like,
right.
But, you know, at one point I looked at our credit card bill and I was like, man, there's a lot of charges at the UCLA cafe and at like the hospital my wife works at, like her cafe, you know, and they're not big ones, right? But it's like, I'm so curious, like, what are the little things like that just eventually, like, I don't think of that. I don't think twice about that little,
yeah,
you know, like, oh, well, I got tired. I didn't make my lunch today. So I'm going to buy, you know, it's, well, it adds, it was 20 bucks lunch. Cause you know, yeah. Like, and yeah. I think it's really easy for us to make exceptions out of the individual decisions. And then we don't see how they kind of add up there.
Totally. And what's interesting back to the earlier conversation about trade-offs is it's not that lunch, or to use that example, we both dislike, you know, the latte example. It's not that that's bad or good.
No.
But the question becomes like, is it something I want to invest in?
Yeah.
And because I'm making a trade-off somewhere else, I'm saying no to something very important over there. Right. And I think that idea of just getting clear, and Morgan's example about the car, he was very clear. Like, if I was a car guy, I'm not saying buying cars is bad.
Yeah.
I'm saying it's not important to me.
You know, this is so funny. This has made me think of two things. One is, can I do one like teeny research thing?
For sure. That's what we're here for.
One of my favorite studies, I mean, this must be 15 years old. It's called the hidden zero effect.
Huh.
And the idea with the hidden zero effect is like, researchers always do the same things. They say, you know, would you rather have 10 bucks now or 15 bucks in 2 weeks? And you say, oh, well, it looks like people really discount the value of future rewards and they're present oriented and they're impulsive and blah, blah. They choose the money now, not later. Well, then some researchers came along and they said, let's change the question. And they changed it to, would you rather have 10 bucks now and $0 in 2 weeks, or $0 now and $15 in 2 weeks? That's the same question.
Yeah.
But they spotlighted what they call the hidden zero, you know, which is that implicitly in the regular conversation, if I choose money now, I get zero later. But if I choose money later, I get zero now. But we don't think about it that way. We just think about, you know, I could get money now or money later. And what you're bringing up is really reminding me of this, which is that in a much broader way, with so many of our financial decisions, our money decisions, we don't think about those. You know, we neglect the opportunity cost, right? We don't think about what those hidden zeros are. And the second thing I was going to say, I have a really good buddy where he teaches, he has the opportunity to pay for the extra parking, the more expensive parking pass, you know, where he could park, you know, right under the building, or he could pay like, I want to say it was like on the order of 50 bucks less a month, maybe 40 bucks, something that's, you know, not insignificant, but not like you could argue, well, it's worth it to park under the buildings. I'm going to take the cheaper parking spot and walk the 7 or 8 minutes, you know, from my park. And then what he does every year is he goes out for a nice dinner with that money that he's, you know, ostensibly saved from doing that, because he's made the calculation that he values a really nice dinner out in Chicago.
Yeah.
Better than being able to each morning, you know, just go right upstairs. And if it's ever miserable outside, he thinks about that dinner.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's a great way of sort of like recognizing that that trade-off, like you said.
Yeah, somebody that you introduced me to that I was going to have on, as a guest on one of my shows that I do, does something very similar with time.
Yeah.
Which I just thought was really beautiful. She, you know, when she says no to something,
yeah,
she has a label in her email system that says declined invitations. And every once in a while she goes in and looks at it to remind herself that she's saying no to things so that she can say yes to the important things, which I was like, man, that's so beautiful. Because time, money, like the idea of setting up some systems where you remind yourself of, you know, there, I can't remember if it was Stephen Covey. I can't remember who said it, but it sounds like Covey. In order to say no to things, we need to give ourselves a much deeper yes.
Yeah. I love that.
And I think like that dinner in Chicago is a deeper yes.
Yeah, totally.
How would you think about, like, what does money mean to you?
Yeah. I love that question. I think it means an opportunity to do more of the thing that I want to do. I think it should mean an opportunity to spend my time in ways that I want to spend it.
Hmm.
I don't know if it always does. If I'm being completely honest with you, I think sometimes I think that money means, you know, better standing.
Hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, and I kind of hate that in a way, you know, and I often do that, you know, someone cliched, but I, you know, often do the thing of like, at a certain point in your life, does anybody care about, you know, let's do it. Let's do, you know, does anybody care about the watch you wear, the car you drive and all that stuff, right? What really matters is like, you know, did you have a good relationship with your kids and your spouse? And, you know, of course, this is so, you know, obvious in a way. So when I think about that, I say, well, why should money mean status? You know, why should it really be associated with that? But I can't help it. You know, I see that and I, you know, I'm aware of it and I try to like not, you know, play into it. And I'll, you know, occasionally I'm a consumer like anybody else, right? And so that blazer might look really good. And I, you know, that costs more than the other ones I have. And, you know, or that car, that watch or whatever, those are material things. But, you know, but I see it also extend to experiential ones too. Like the long weekend we had, the vacation we had, and, you know, those are things that can't happen without more money. And, you know, sometimes I think using money in a way to buy more of something, whether it's material or experiential, you know, affords like a little bit of a sense of like, oh, I've arrived, I've done it. And, but, you know, I don't mean to be black and white about it, you know, because I think there are times when it's like, all I wanted to do was put in an outdoor grill at our house. It is like, I've been wanting this for years. And we finally did it. And I remember like sitting outside the first time I like made something out there. And it was like this kind of hilarious moment because I, in my mind, I'd built up and I was going to be out there with a drink and it was going to be this like, aha. And like one of my kids was like having an epic tantrum inside. And I was like, this isn't quite what I thought it was, but I still had that moment of being like, okay, you know, like this is like a physical thing that also creates experiences that I worked hard for. And in that moment, money was a representation of working hard to do something that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so there, you know, there's a little bit of that trade-off there that like in my world, and it's not always true, and it's not always true in everyone's world, but like there are times when more effort can be more money, but you know, that's not always the case. But in that particular case, you know, I think I'd taken on some extra work, some outside consulting, and I could sort of point to that and say like, because I did that, I was able to use that money and we could put it toward the grill. And that felt good. You know, sometimes I think money is a representation of something, you know, of like blood, sweat, and tears I've put in to get something else.
Yeah. I can't help but ask, tell me about the money equals status ick feeling.
It's funny. I think you prime me because you mentioned Morgan and the cars, and I've never been a car guy. I could really care less. I just want to, you know, something that's safe and, you know, that's like not terrible to drive. But when my daughter started kindergarten, and I'm in LA, so let's just, you know, be transparent. this was like during COVID, you know, there wasn't the bus running, blah, blah. And we'd have to drive and wait in the line of cars. And the first time in my life, I started feeling self-conscious of how old our car was. And I had this thought of like, you know, if we had just an abundance of discretionary income, maybe we should just buy, like, upgrade and buy a nicer car, a newer car, you know, because I was looking around and I was like, God, everyone's got these nicer, like the bigger SUV and the blah, blah, blah. And this is the EV and, you know, and I was like, ugh. And I hated that feeling because it was like, that's the ick part. You know, the money status was like, more money, I could get a nicer car. And I was like, why do I care? You know, like, first of all, people aren't even like, are they, do they really care? Are they judging me? And if they are, like, you know, whatever. And, you know, one of those days, it was like pretty early on, I look and like, the car next to me is this like incredibly beat up Ford truck. Like, I'm talking rust, you know, like you can picture. And I was like, wow, that is, you know, well, that's a bookend to our like old car. And I look over and there's sitting in the car. And is the doors don't even open in the back. His kid literally jumps in. And I thought, you know, it's a very funny feeling of like, again, like, you know, this is like, part of being where I live, there's people who are, you know, in the movie industry or whatever. And I thought, he's not concerned. I mean, in some ways, it's almost more of a status thing to be like, I can
right.
drive.
Right. Like the hoodie.
Beat up car, you know, the hoodie. It's the hoodie of cars, right? Yeah. Yeah. But it was, you know, it was such a funny realization. And it kind of like snapped me out of it a little bit. And, you know, like 3 years later, or whatever it was, 2.5 years later, like we finally got a new car, like I was saying, you know, but like, I waited because it was like that was the trade-off there, you know? Yeah. And yeah.
That's so good. Hal, thanks for having this conversation.
Thanks for asking all the great questions. This is awesome.
Yeah. Cheers. I was so touched by the level of introspection and honesty that Hal shared. Keep in mind that what you just listened to was one of the world's leading experts on making decisions. And what you heard was how much he struggles with making decisions about money. Let me take you back to the very early part of our conversation when Hal used the words obsessed in relationship to a coin. And he remembers sort of holding the coin and having this feeling, he said, that it meant something. And then we spent a half an hour talking about what it meant. And in the end, Hal was open and honest in a way I've come to expect from Hal about the struggle of making sense with what money means in our lives. This idea that money, and he said it, if I'm completely honest, sometimes money means better standing. And I kind of hate that. It's so fascinating to me that when we actually get under the surface in terms of what money means to us, when we actually allow ourselves to have an honest conversation like we were sitting around a fire with a friend late at night, the things that come up are feelings, right? Who let the feelings into this conversation about money? I thought it was about spreadsheets and calculators and Hal's talking about the trade-offs that we make, the impact it has on our kids. The fact that sometimes it makes us feel like, hey, I've done it, I've arrived, and the conflict that that causes. So one of the things I took away from this conversation was the idea that money means much more to us than we let on. Money is much more about feelings than it is about spreadsheets and calculators. Money has deep meaning in terms of providing for our kids, and what does it mean to provide? And so those are the kind of conversations I would imagine. In fact, my wife and I are leaving on a road trip right after we record this. And I'm planning on talking with her about this idea of what does it mean to provide as a parent and what's the role of money in that experience. And I hope that will be a useful conversation for you as well. Cheers, my friends. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. If you find this show valuable, and I sure hope you do, please share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 or maybe even 8-star review over on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to more people. Speaking of more people, I have a goal that we can use 50 Fires as a spark to start a million conversations a month about money. I've heard from so many of you about the conversations you're having around the dinner table, on a road trip in the car, or at your favorite coffee shop, and I think we need more. So if you've got a friend or a family member that you think would benefit from having a conversation about money, or if you happen to give advice for a living, we've created a whole set of free resources. Think of it as a book club about money. It's over at 50fires.com, and you can use it every week. We're updating it every week so that you can help me start a million conversations a month about money. I'm looking forward to our next conversation around the fire. Cheers, my friends.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in this series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nell Audio, nor Magnolia.